This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Well, welcome back, everyone, on another damp Wednesday evening. Thank you for coming out. It's a thrill to be here again with you. So first I just want to mention that I have no conflict of interest with anything I'm presenting in this lecture. I'm not affiliated with any drug companies or any industry or anything else. And I want to acknowledge a couple colleagues who generously allowed me to borrow some of their slides for the presentation I'm going to give tonight. So I want to acknowledge Dr. Derisi, Dr. Rowan, and Dr. Nussbaum for their help. So last week, we talked about sort of the basics of genetics, genes, genomes, chromosomes, and we talked a bit about different types of genetic variation. We talked about mutations and polymorphisms. And to remind you of the patient Elizabeth that was introduced on the first session 4 weeks ago by Dr. Gundling, and Elizabeth has common variable immune deficiency, or CVID, and I gave you a little information last time about the genetics of this disorder, and share with you that about 10 to 20% of individuals with this disease have a known genetic cause. The others, the cause is not clear, but there's likely some genetic component. But for these individuals, it's a known genetic cause where they have a defect in a particular gene, one of five genes, and it's inherited in either autosomal dominant or autosomal recessive manner. And so that's what we're going to talk about tonight, is what autosomal dominant, autosomal recessive, and different inheritance patterns. So that's what we'll start off tonight, is talking about inheritance of genetic disease. We'll go through autosomal and X-linked inheritance patterns and look at sex chromosomes and how that affects the X-linked inheritance. And then we're going to get a little more sophisticated and talk about some factors that affect the expression of diseases, so why we see diseases play out differently in different patients. And then we'll look at some ways that we look, that we test for genetic diseases, both single gene disorders and chromosomal disorders. And then also talk a bit about how we analyze entire genomes, which is really the frontier of technology right now. So our learning goals for tonight are listed here. So by the end of the session, I hope that you are able to recognize the inheritance patterns for autosomal dominant, autosomal recessive, and X-linked disorders, and we'll define what they are, and to describe factors that affect phenotypic expression of disease and observed inheritance patterns. So what are things that affect the way that people actually present with different diseases? And then I hope that you'll be able to describe the methods for analyzing single gene mutations, chromosomes, and whole genomes on a big picture level. So the first thing I'm going to focus on is the inheritance of genetic disease. Now, I first want to say that you guys were so great last time. You had really good questions. And so there's just so much that I want to share with you. And so I put a lot into this talk, and we probably won't cover all of the slides. And that's okay. I just wanted you to have that material, but we'll see how far we get. So to start off with, we're going to talk about inheritance of genetic disorders, and I'm going to start off with some basics of inheritance patterns. And I first want to review the concept that I started with last week, that all disease is due to some combination of genetic factors and environmental factors. So I want you to always keep that in mind. Whatever we're talking about, there's always going to be some influence of both of these factors, okay? So if we think about the spectrum of the causes of disease, at one end of the spectrum are those diseases that are mainly due to genetic factors, right? And some examples include cystic fibrosis, which is due to a defect in a single gene, CFTR, or a disease like Down syndrome that's due to a chromosomal abnormality. If you have these abnormalities, you basically have that disease, all right? At the other end of the spectrum are those diseases that are mainly due to environmental factors. So something like an infectious disease like the measles, okay, or lung cancer that's due to cigarette smoke, something that is due to environmental insults. In between these two extremes are the majority of human diseases that are called multifactorial. and they're due to multiple factors, multiple genetic and environmental factors that come together in different ways. And these diseases like diabetes, stroke, hypertension, Alzheimer's disease, they play out a little bit differently in each patient. Okay. So what we're going to focus on today are these disorders down here. We're going to look at the inheritance of these genetic disorders. And remember that with CVID, I said there are those that are inherited in an autosomal dominant and autosomal recessive fashion that functions like these genetic disorders. And then there are those that are multifactorial, where there are multiple genetic and environmental factors that have not all yet been identified. Okay, so I first want to define for you dominance versus recessiveness within genetics. Okay, so what do we mean by recessive when we're talking about a genetic disease? So those of you guys that are in high school probably know this, right? When we talk about recessive, what does that mean? It means that you require, in order to see the disease, you have to have a mutation in both copies of that gene. Remember, we have two copies of every gene, right? So for a recessive disease, you have to have a mutation in both of those copies of the genes, the one you have got from your mom and the one you got from your dad. Now, if you have one normal copy and one mutant copy, you're called heterozygous, and then you're a carrier. So you are normal, you don't have that disease, but you are carrying that mutation, and you can pass it on to your offspring, to your children. If you are homozygous, that means that you have two copies of the same mutation. So both of the copies of your gene have the same mutation. Or you can be what's called a compound heterozygote, which means that you have two mutations, but they're two different mutations. So you got mutation A from your mom and mutation B from your dad in the same gene. So you still end up with the disease. Now, on the other hand, what do we mean by dominant in referring to genetic disorders? A dominant disorder is one that requires only one copy of the bad gene in order to develop the disease. Okay, so you have one normal copy and one mutant copy, and you develop the disease. And so in which case, if you're heterozygous, then you're affected. Now, what happens if you're homozygous, if you have two copies of the mutant allele? In this case, with human genetic diseases, they are more severely affected. All right. So whether you have two copies of the same mutation or two different mutations in that gene, you're more severely affected. And very often, these are lethal very early in life or even embryonic lethals. So single gene disorders are actually pretty common. There are about 5,000 different single gene or Mendelian disorders that have been characterized. And Mendelian after Gregor Mendel, our good old Gregor Mendel, who did his experiments with the peas. And about 2,000 of these single gene disorders have a known gene, a known genetic defect that causes that disease. So there are many genetic disorders that we know are genetic disorders based on the family history, based on the inheritance pattern, but the actual gene or the actual defect is not yet identified. So for all of you high school students out there, as you go on in your careers, we have lots of work to do, okay? Single gene disorders affect about 10 out of every 1,000 live births, which is about 1%, right? So 7 out of 1,000 are autosomal dominant. So that's the majority of single gene disorders are autosomal dominant. About 2.5 out of 1,000 are autosomal recessive. And less than half out of 1,000, less than 0.5 out of 1,000, are X-linked or sex-linked. So this is what we call a pedigree. A pedigree is a diagrammatic illustration of a family history. All right, the squares are males, the circles are females. How many of you are familiar with pedigrees? How many have seen this before? About half of you. Okay, so for the rest of you, let's just go over quickly what these symbols mean so you'll know what we're looking at here. So as I said, the squares are males, the circles are females. So up here, we have great-grandparents. The lines through them indicate that these people are deceased. And the ones that are colored in, these symbols here, mean that that person is affected with the disorder that you're looking at. Okay? And these dots here, those indicate we're looking at a recessive disorder. These are carriers. These are individuals that are heterozygous, that have one copy of the mutation and can pass it on, but they themselves are not affected with the disease. Okay? So in this case, we're looking at an autosomal recessive disorder. And we see these two individuals up here, this couple, both happen to be carriers of the same genetic disorder, and they have two affected children. So these affected children both inherited the mutant copy of the gene from mom and from dad, versus these other this daughter affected the two inherited the two normal copies of the gene, and this son over here inherited one normal copy and one mutant copy. Okay, so that's what we're looking at here. And now when these two individuals had children, they have an affected child as well. So this is looking at the different generations. This is the youngest generation, the newest generation. This is the next generation up of their parents, and this is the grandparent generation and the great-grandparent generation. And typically when you look at a pedigree, you have the youngest individual to the right and the eldest individual to the left as you're looking through a family. So there's a very methodical way of diagramming a family history. So to summarize what we see for autosomal recessive disorders when we look at the pattern of inheritance within a family, you see skipped generations because these individuals up here are carriers, but they don't have the disease, but they can pass it on. So you tend to see with autosomal recessive disorders clustering of the disease within a particular generation, okay, which is what's illustrated here. And the disease can be passed on by both males and females, and both males and females are affected equally. And consanguinity, does anybody know what consanguinity is? Sharing blood. Somebody said something else? Relatedness, exactly. So these are more closely related individuals. So typically of like first cousin marriages or something closely related like that. Now, individuals that are related have a higher chance of sharing more of their genetic background in common. So there's more of a chance of them carrying a mutation for the same recessive disorder. And that's what we see over here. These two individuals are first cousins, and they happen to both be carriers for the same mutation, and they end up having two children that are affected with that disorder. So when I say down here, consanguinity may result in an affected offspring because these individuals tend to have more of their genetic background in common, so you more often see genetic disorder show up in a family that has a consanguineous marriage. So I'm looking at an example here of cystic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis is an autosomal recessive disorder that affects the lungs and the digestive system, the pancreas. And what I'm showing you here, it's the same family. I'm just showing you a little bit more detail. And there's a reason. I'm going to come back to this in a little bit. But I just want to show you here that these people are all affected with the disease. So we could have them all blackened in like we did in the previous one. But what I'm showing here are the individual symptoms that each of these people have, because each of these patients have slightly different form of cystic fibrosis. So, for example, this male over here has pancreatic sufficiency, so they have a problem with digesting their food. And they also are infertile and have lung disease, okay? Whereas this individual over here does not have the pancreatic insufficiency or does not have the digestive problem, but has the lung disease and infertility, all right? So there are ways that genetic counselors and medical geneticists can keep track of different traits within a family by using this type of characters. This is an example of an autosomal dominant pattern of inheritance. So in this pedigree, the numbers here are the ages that when the family history was taken. This arrow over here indicates this person that we call the proband. The proband is the person that shows up in the doctor's office. So this guy shows up in the doctor's office at 34 years old, and the physician takes the family history, and this is the age and of all the people at that time. Okay, so when they have a line through it, that's the age that they passed away. So, and again, the squares are male, the circles are female, the lines are those that are deceased, and these blackened symbols are those that are affected. These these are the children of this couple. This over here indicates, the little triangle indicates twins. Okay, so these are monozygotic twins. And this indicates a miscarriage. Okay, so you can see some things that are going on within this family. So some of the characteristic features of an autosomal dominant pattern of inheritance are that you see it in every generation. Remember, for autosomal dominant disease, it only requires one mutant copy of that gene in order to see the disorder. So therefore, you see it in every generation, right? You only have to inherit the mutation from mom or dad. You don't need it from both like you do for autosomal recessive disorder. So it's very characteristic for autosomal dominant to see it in every generation. Both males and females are both affected and can both pass on the disease. And approximately 50% of the children are affected, of an individual who is affected. So we can see here this woman is affected and one of her children is affected. We don't have a whole lot of children here to see that with. But in general, 50%, because you have two copies of every gene. So if an individual is affected and has one mutant copy, there's a 50% chance in their egg or their sperm that they're going to pass on the normal copy and 50% chance that they pass on the mutant copy. So therefore, 50% of the children on average would be affected. So this is basically the same pedigree. This family has a disease called neurofibromatosis, and this is one of the most common single gene disorders. It affects one in 3,500 people, which is actually pretty common. And this is a disease that affects the nervous system, skin, and eyes. And the different symptoms are listed over here, and I'll show you pictures of those in just a moment. And this, again, just shows that these individuals that are all affected, that I showed you in the last pedigree, were all solid colors, all shaded in completely, shows that they have different symptoms. They don't all have the exact same disease. So this great-grandmother up here has, let me see over here, what's called neurofibromas, which are little like little benign skin tumors. And this daughter here, her who is a grandmother, has freckling, has a lot of freckling, and café au lait spots. And café au lait spots are like big, large pigmented regions, darker pigmented regions on the skin. And this child over here has the Lish nodules, which are little benign tumors in the eye, as well as the café au lait spots. So you can see that even though all these individuals have the same disease, they have a little bit different versions of the disease. So this is just to show you what some of these signs and symptoms are. The neurofibromas, these little skin, little like benign skin tumors, the Lish nodules that you can see here in the eye, and café au lait spots that can be small or can be quite large. Some individuals have a café au lait spot that covers their entire back, so they can be quite large. And sometimes individuals with neurofibromatosis can have very severe nervous system tumors that are called neurofibrosarcomas that can be deadly, and they're like a tumor on the spinal cord. Okay, so the next inheritance pattern that we want to talk about is X-linked inheritance. And before we talk about X-linked inheritance, I want to review some points about the sex chromosomes. So to remind you, in humans, we have two sex chromosomes, the X and the Y. And these two chromosomes don't look alike, do they? They're very different. They're called heteromorphic, for hetero, for different. So in humans, what determines the sex is the Y chromosome. The presence of the Y chromosome means male. The absence of the Y chromosome, the default, is female. Okay, simple as that. Presence of the Y chromosome is male. Now, the X chromosome and the Y chromosome, as I said, are quite different. There are about 1,000 genes on the X chromosome and only about 50 genes on the Y chromosome. Now, there are two problems that nature had to solve because we have these two different sex chromosomes. The first is that, if you remember, I talked a little bit about last week, when we create our eggs and our sperm, our gametes, the chromosomes, we have all our chromosomes line up and pair off, and then they divide, and they segregate to the daughter cells. And it's very important for them to be able to pair. And somebody mentioned last time that this is when the crossing over occurs, right, during this stage, when the homologous chromosomes pair up. So this is a very important point to happen in order for us to make our eggs and our sperm, to make our gametes. So how do we manage that when the X and the Y don't have anything to pair with in a male? The other problem is that females have two X chromosomes and males have only one. So what about these 1,000 genes? How come, you know, we can be so similar when the women have two copies and males have just one copy? So to get across, to get around the first problem, very interestingly, there are sequences on the tips of the X and the Y chromosome. This is a diagram of the X chromosome and the Y chromosome, and this is a particular banding pattern. I'll show you this in just a few moments when we talk about chromosomes. And on the tip here, this is called the pseudo-autosomal region, which is a region that is similar to what happens on the autosomal chromosomes versus the sex chromosomes. These two regions are the same on the X and the Y, this region and this region. And that allows them to pair up during meiosis, the process of meiosis, and segregate properly to the daughter cells, okay, to the gametes. Problem number two is that women have two X chromosomes and males have one. And we get around this by a process called X inactivation. So in females, one of our X's in every cell is inactivated, okay? And this is the mechanism. This is called dosage compensation of genes. So this is a way that we have the same amount of genes being expressed in our cells. One X chromosome in all the female cells is inactivated. And when it's inactivated, it condenses down to what's called a bar body. And you can see this through a microscope in a cell. It stains like a little dark blob on the edge of the cell. And this is a process that happens very early on in development, about the 50-cell stage, so very, very early on. Once the cell decides which X is going to be inactivated, whether it's the one that you got from mom or the one that you got from dad in that particular cell, once the decision is made, it's the same for all the progeny of that cell. Okay, so we're starting off at a 50-cell stage. We're going to end up with 100 trillion cells, right, in our body. So all the daughter cells from that cell are going to have the same X inactivated. So the process is random, but it's stable, and it happens early on. And again, the inactive X that condenses down is called the bar body. So as a result of this, females are what we call mosaics. We have two different populations of cells in our body, all right? So we have some cells that are the X that we inherited from our dad is active, and other cells, the X that we inherited from our mom is active, all right? So this is illustrated very nicely with tortoise shell cats. Their coat color, the dark color and the light color, that coat color gene is on the X chromosome, and tortoiseshell cats are only female cats, right? You don't see male tortoiseshell cats, only females. And that's because this little patch here, this X chromosome, is the one that's expressing the dark coat color. The one that's expressing the light coat color is the one that's inactivated. And over here in this light patch, the X chromosome that has the light coat color gene is active, and the one with the dark coat color gene is inactive. So this is a pedigree of an X-linked showing X-linked inheritance of an X-linked disease. And what we see here is that males are affected much more often than females. Rarely a female is affected, and I'll tell you why in just a moment. So what we see here, we're going up to the grandparent generation here. So when a male is affected, he has one X chromosome, right? So males are affected more commonly because they only have one X chromosome. So if they have inherited that X chromosome from their mother, they're affected with the disease, okay? Whereas females, and this gets to your point, have two X chromosomes, and it just depends on the ratio of cells that have the mutant X versus the normal X. And if by chance you have genetic bad luck and have a majority of those cells early on expressing the mutant gene versus the normal gene, the female is affected. Whereas most of the time, there is compensation going on because there is a mix of cells. And depending what the gene is and what tissue it's expressed in, so it really depends on the specific disease. But for example, if there is an enzyme in the liver and you have enough of it made to get by, you're not going to see that disease in a female. But if it's a critical gene where, you know, 50% of it is not quite enough, then you'll see the disorder. So it really comes down to a ratio of the percentage of cells that are expressing the normal X versus the percentage of cells expressing the mutant X. And that's going to be random. Question. So that's a good question. So the question is, I think what you're actually getting at is how early do the cells differentiate? So you're asking is if the mutation is just in the nerve cells, it will just affect the nervous system. for X inactivation, this process occurs before cells differentiate. Okay, so in this case, they populate all the different tissues and cells of our body, okay? But the point you bring up can be for another type of mutation that might occur during development. If a mutation occurs in an embryo during development and happens to affect a progenitor just to the nervous system, that disease will just be expressed in the nervous system. And there are many examples of that. That's actually, there's a name for that. That's somatic mosaicism, yes. Okay, yes. Not yet. So does that 50, each of those 50 cells have a distinct future? Not yet. They're not yet determined. Okay, so this occurs before the cells have determined what they're going to divide into. We call that differentiation, when the cells differentiate into becoming a nerve cell versus a muscle cell versus a kidney cell. This is before that happens. Question? Right. So the question is, can you select the cells that are not expressing the mutation? That we cannot do. You can't get at that level to select specific cells. But there are ways for people that have trouble with fertility or something, they want to go through in vitro fertilization. There are ways to select an embryo that is a healthy embryo versus an unhealthy embryo. But we can't get quite at the cellular level. Okay. Good questions. Okay, so some of the characteristics then to review for X-linked inheritance is that you never see father-to-son transmission. You never see a father passing on the disease to the son. Why is that? A father is passing on his Y chromosome to his son, not his X chromosome. Okay, so a male is going to pass on his X chromosome to his daughters and his Y chromosome to his son. Right? The female is only passing on an X, so the father is basically determining the sex of the child. So you can see here that this father, all of his daughters are carriers because he only has a mutant X to pass on. So all of his daughters now have one mutant X from their dad and the normal X from their mom. And then they can pass that mutant X on to their son, and if they pass that mutant X on, their husband passes on the normal Y chromosome, so now this individual is affected, their son is affected, okay? So you never see a male passing on the disease to another male. Males are more frequently affected for the reasons that we described. You also may see skipped generations for this reason, that females are usually carriers, they're much less frequently affected with the disease, and the disease is then transmitted from the moms. Okay. So now I want to get to a little more sophisticated level. We were talking about, earlier I showed you in the pedigrees for the neurofibromatosis and cystic fibrosis, I showed you that the different individuals in those family had somewhat different symptoms. So why is that? What causes the variability in disease phenotype? So there are a couple concepts I want to define for you. One is penetrance, and you can now show off that you know these genetic terms, okay? So penetrance is the probability that if you inherit the mutation, you also develop the disease. There are occasions for certain diseases that not everybody who has a mutation also develops the disease. This is called penetrance. And if 100% of the time, if you get the mutation, you have the disease, then that disease is fully penetrant. It's everybody, you see the disease if you have the mutation. If there is not everybody that has a mutation, so for example, if 90% of the people that have the mutation actually have the disease and 10% don't, that's called reduced penetrance. And you'd say that that disease had 90% penetrance. Okay. Another concept is called variable expression or variable expressivity. And this is more the fine-tuning of the disease. If you have the disease, how severe is it? What specific symptoms do you have? That's the variable expression of the disease. So this is, penetrance is like the on-off. You have the disease or you don't. And variable expression is, you have the disease, how severe is it? Another concept I want to define for you is called pleiotropy. It's a gene has pleiotropic effects if it can have effects on different systems, different cell types, different tissues. Okay? So it's pleiotropic effects on the body. So to just reinforce the idea, the difference between penetrance and variable expression, penetrance is like a radio on-off dial. Okay, you either have it or you don't. Whereas variable expression is like the fine-tuning of the station. Okay, so I think that's a good way to remember. That's how I always remember the difference with those when I was in school. The causes of variable expression of the disease are many. So we talked a bit about last time as well, when we talked about different types of genetic variation. And even within, for example, cystic fibrosis, I told you that you can have many different mutations in that same gene within the population. That is called genetic heterogeneity. So you can have different alleles of that gene, different mutations of that gene. And those different mutations may affect that protein in different ways that might lead to more or less severe disease. There are also, each individual has their own specific genetic makeup, what we call is the different modifier genes. There are different things that might affect the expression of that mutant gene. And, of course, environmental factors can play a role as well. So all these different things play a role in how each one of us and each individual patient will express their own unique version of a disease. Now, to show you pleiotropy, I have an example here of Marfan syndrome. And Marfan syndrome is due to a defect in the fibrillin gene. And this is a gene that makes a protein that's in the extracellular matrix. So it's in the matrix around cells, and it plays a structural role in the body. And people with Marfan syndrome have skeletal problems. They are very tall and have long bones and a curved back, problems with their spine. Ocular or problems with their eye, myopia, and they have detached lens, so there's a problem with the connective tissue there, and cardiovascular problems, so they have heart defects. Again, there's some defects in the connective tissues in the heart. So Marfan syndrome is an example of pleiotropy because this one gene can affect all these different systems. Okay. All right, so now this is a classic example, again, of an autosomal dominant family, of an autosomal dominant pattern of inheritance, and we can see that it's in every generation. Over here, however, we see this individual that's affected. Her parents are not affected. Her grandparents are not affected. So how can she have this disease? Let's think about that. So there are a few different reasons for that. One is that this individual may have a new mutation, okay? New mutations do happen. They're not always inherited. And in fact, for certain autosomal dominant and X-linked disorders, new mutations are very common. For neurofibromatosis, believe it or not, about half the times, 50% of the cases, are due to new mutations. Another reason that you might see a sporadic case of a disease in a family without a history is misattributed paternity. So, believe it or not, there are studies that have showed that misattributed paternity accounts for about 5% of pregnancies. It's pretty high. Misattributed paternity means that the father you think is the father is not the father.
And you can identify.
Yes. Yes, you can identify that by genetic studies, like forensic studies. Yes. Okay? So misattributed paternity means a different father. So the person who's really the father might have the disease or might have a family history of the disease that you're not aware of at the time. Another reason is what we just talked about, reduced penetrance. So maybe one of the parents actually has the mutation but is not penetrant, is not showing that disease for a disorder that has reduced penetrance. Another reason is that certain disorders don't express until adulthood. So something like Alzheimer's disease or Huntington's disease are diseases of adulthood. So when you're looking at a family history, you might not know everybody that's affected yet. So it just might not be clear yet who has the disease and who doesn't. Okay, so before we go on, here's another pedigree. What do you think is the pattern of inheritance here? Little quiz.
Autosomal dominant.
Sure looks like it, doesn't it? I tricked you. Guess what it is? It's mitochondrial. So remember last week we talked about how we have DNA in our mitochondria as well as in our nucleus? So there are disorders that are due to defects in the genes in our mitochondria. And the pattern of inheritance looks very similar to autosomal dominant, except that if you look at this carefully, who is passing on the disease? mother, only the mother's, right? The mitochondria is in the cytoplasm of the egg. So mitochondria is always maternally inherited. It's always passed on from the mother. So if a mother is affected with the disease, all of her children will be affected. There might be some variation in how severely they're affected, but the children will be affected because they're all getting that mutant mitochondria. So if this woman, both of her children are affected. This is his wife, and this child, it's her husband. So her children are these two, okay? And this woman here, these are her three children right here. And this woman here, these are her three children right there. So this is showing that all their children are affected, okay? There might be some variation in that as it plays out, but for all intents and purposes, they're all affected. So the mitochondria, to remind you, is the powerhouse of the cell. It's what makes the energy that allows us to do everything that we do. It makes ATP. And each cell, this is an electromicrograph of a mitochondria. So looking at a cell through an electron microscope, these are very, very small. This is an image of a mitochondria. And there are hundreds of these in each cell. And each of these has multiple copies of its mitochondrial chromosome. And the mitochondrial chromosome is a bit different than the nuclear chromosomes that we looked at, the 46 chromosomes. This is a circular chromosome, and it has a lot of differences between the other chromosomes and the genes in our nucleus. One big difference is that there are no introns, it's just exons. And there's a high mutation rate because it doesn't have the same repair systems that are in the nucleus. And the genes are involved mainly with the process of making ATP. So therefore, if you have a defect in one of these genes, it's going to affect the cells that have the highest requirement for ATP. Does anybody have an idea what cells in our body have the highest requirement? Yes. Muscle cells? Yep. Very good. Yes. Brain, nerve cells, exactly. So those are the two, muscle and nerve. So therefore, very good guys. So therefore, if you have a defect in one of these genes, it most likely will affect the nerves and muscles. So these are associated with neuromuscular disorders. Okay? So to review this, mitochondrial inheritance is basically, the pattern is maternal inheritance. All the children are affected of the females that are affected. No children of an affected male are affected because they're not passing on any of their cytoplasm, any of their mitochondria. There is a lot of variability, so I didn't go into the details of this, but because when the cell divides, the cytoplasm divides not precisely. So the mitochondria can split off differently, so there might be different percentages of normal to mutant mitochondria in the different daughter cells. So there can be a lot of variability in the presentation of mitochondrial disorders, okay? And then again, these mutations most frequently affect nerves and muscles, just as you guys said, that's excellent. So to summarize this part of the lecture, the inheritance traits, we talked about patterns of inheritance, autosomal dominant, or autosomal recessive, X-linked inheritance, and mitochondrial. And we talked about how sex is determined in humans by the presence of the Y chromosome, and X inactivation occurs in females. And variability of disease phenotype can be due to reduced penetrance and variable expression, and the difference between those, penetrance is on or off, variable expression is how severely you're affected. Pleiotropy means that one gene can affect multiple organ systems. And then we talked about how new cases of a disease can be seen without a family history from new mutation, misattributed paternity, reduced penetrance, and delayed age of onset. Question? Okay, so you're asking about when the mutation shows up and does it change. So mutation, which we're talking about here, are mutations that are inherited. And it is once you have that genetic change, it's in every cell of your body, and it stays that way for your whole life. Okay, it doesn't change typically. There are some other more sophisticated things that can happen, but for most part, if you inherit a mutation, it's in all the cells of your body and it stays the same way. If the disease is, I'm thinking if you're talking about like an adult onset disease, the mutation does not change. It's there. It's just that it takes many years in order for that to actually manifest, the problem to manifest into a disease state. But the mutation itself is actually there from conception from the beginning. Okay? All right, so now we're going to shift and talk a little bit about genetic testing and the ways that we, the methods that are used to analyze genes and chromosomes and genomes. So first of all, why do genetic testing? Why would you do genetic test? So one of the main reasons is to diagnose a disease. So if parents have a sick child, they want to know what's going on. And a very important reason to find out what the cause is to find out if there is a treatable cause. You want to know, like, if this disease is treatable or if there is what the prognosis is for the child. And if there's something, for example, if a child has developmental delay, you want to know if it's due to lead poisoning versus whether it's due to a metabolic disorder. You might be able to have some treatment or there might not be a treatment, but you want to be able to know that as soon as possible to be able to prevent the disease from getting worse if you can. Also, for genetic diseases, which is very different than other kinds of diseases, if you make a diagnosis of a genetic disease, it does not just affect that particular patient, it affects their entire family because other people in the family may be at risk for this disease. And it's also very helpful for couples for family planning for future pregnancies. So for a couple that might have a family history themselves, they might want to know if they are carriers of a mutation before they have children. Or for a couple that has one child who is affected with a disease, they want to know what their chances are of having another child with a genetic disease. So these are some of the reasons why people might choose to do genetic testing. And I want to emphasize that genetic testing should always, always be done in combination with genetic counseling. They do pre- and post-test genetic counseling. So they'll meet with the people before they have the genetic test, explain what the test will do, what the results will tell you and what it won't tell you, and then after you have the results, they sit and go over those results with you so you understand it. So I'm not going to go over what genetic counselors do tonight, but I just want to make that point that it's very important to have genetic counseling. And again, because the results of a genetic test is very different than the results of other kinds of laboratory tests, because it does affect the entire family. So first, let's look at single gene mutations. How can we identify a single gene mutation? So if we want to find a single gene mutation, we have to be able to find the gene first. And we have this one gene in the sea of all that DNA. How in the world can we find that to be able to test for it? The answer is, first, we have to make a whole lot of copies of that gene. So we have enough DNA in the test tube in the lab to actually do something with it, okay? And we can make lots of copies of it using this process called PCR, polymerase chain reaction. Is anybody familiar with polymerase chain reaction, PCR? Several of you. Okay, very good. So you'll understand this process. So PCR was developed by the scientist Kerry Mullis, and he not only is a great scientist, he's a great surfer, and he has his book here that came out a couple years ago, and Kerry Mullis has a Nobel Prize for inventing the polymerase chain reaction, and he came up, this is such a great story, he came up with the idea while he was driving down the highway. He lives here in California. He was driving down Highway 128 to get to his cabin. And he had this great idea of how you could make lots of copies of DNA in a test tube. And he single-handedly revolutionized molecular biology. So pretty darn amazing. And so what he came up with was an idea that's based on what our cells do naturally, how our cells actually replicate DNA. And he also thought about what exists out in nature. So this technique uses what's called a DNA probe or primer. This DNA primer, which is a little snippet of DNA that binds to the region that you're interested in. So if you know the sequence that you are interested in, you can make a little primer of DNA that will bind to that region in the genome. So it's basically like a little tag that goes in with all the DNA in your cell, and it finds that place and it binds to it. And then adding in the nucleotides, remember we talked about nucleotides last time, the building blocks of DNA, A, C, G, T. You add in those nucleotides and this little biological machine, an enzyme called DNA polymerase, which polymerizes or makes DNA, copies the DNA. It uses these nucleotides and it makes copies this strand of DNA. Okay. So to do this in a test tube and make lots of copies of it, it cycles through temperatures. And when you cycle through a high temperature, it allows the DNA double helix, the two-stranded DNA, to do what we call denature. It separates it into two single strands. And that allows this little primer here to bind to that single strand. And for PCR, because you want to make lots of copies of a specific sequence, so you have a little primer on one side and a little primer on the other side to define the ends of that piece of DNA that you want to copy. And those two primers then bind to the DNA when it's single-stranded. And then the polymerase comes in and zips across and makes copies. And you do this multiple rounds, about 30 times, as this test tube is sitting in this little machine. Then basically what that machine does is it raises the temperature and lowers the temperature and raises the temperature and lowers the temperature for very specific times and has very specific temperatures. And it allows this process to go again and again and again, and you exponentially make lots and lots of DNA. So I have a little video that a colleague of mine made that I wanted to share with you. So this is showing our double-stranded DNA. It's unwinding. And now watch the temperature here. So the temperature is going up, and the DNA separates. Now you can see the little primers come in and bind. There they are. The little primers are binding to the two ends of the region that you want. There are the DNA polymerase, and zip, it makes copies. And it's going to do that again and again. Now the temperature goes up again. Those strands separate. The primers come in, and they're going to bind to those two regions. DNA polymerase comes in, zip, 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 and makes lots of copies. And you just do this again and again and again. You can imagine after 30 cycles, you have hundreds and hundreds of copies of that DNA. Pretty cool, huh? Nobel Prize worthy. Now you have enough DNA from PCR that you can actually run it out on a gel. This is what we use in the lab to analyze DNA. And a gel is made of agarose, which comes from seaweed, basically. And it's a gel. It's kind of like jello. It's like thick jello. And you put an electrical current on there, and it DNA is charged, so it moves from the one end, from the positive to the negative. It separates it by size, so you're able to see different pieces of DNA according to their size. Okay. Now, once we have a lot of that DNA in the lab, now you can look for a mutation in that sequence. Okay, and we do that by sequencing that stretch of DNA. DNA sequencing is the gold standard for looking for a mutation because it is actually looking at the exact sequence of that gene, okay, or of the segment of the gene, whatever you're looking at. So DNA sequencing can allow you to detect a single nucleotide change. We talked last time about single nucleotide changes, so you might have a T instead of an A in a specific place. It allows you to pick up small insertions of a couple extra nucleotides or a deletion of a few nucleotides. So any kind of small mutation within a gene, DNA sequencing can pick that up. What it doesn't pick up is large changes or large deletions or a whole chromosome abnormality. It doesn't pick that up. And this is particularly useful for identifying a familial mutation. So the examples that we talked about today with cystic fibrosis or Marfan syndrome or neurofibromatosis, it can pick up those mutations. It's particularly useful if you know the family, the mutation in the family, you can look for that specific mutation. It is also useful for familial cancer syndromes. So for people that have familial breast cancer or familial colon cancer in their family, and they want to know if they're at risk for developing those types of cancer, you can have a test done. Yes?
So that means you make the primer according to what you're looking for.
You make the primer according to what you're looking for. So the primer is going to be gene-specific, okay? So this shows the basic scheme of DNA sequencing. So similar to what we were talking about with PCR, we have this primer, but in this case, we just have one primer. We're just copying this DNA one direction. And what sequencing takes advantage of is, so a normal nucleotide here has this this hydroxyl group, okay? sequencing reactions use a dideoxyterminator nucleotide. So this hydroxyl group is missing, and this hydroxyl group is required to add on the next nucleotide in the chain. So if you don't have that hydroxyl group there, you can't add the next nucleotide. So it terminates the chain. So what you do for sequencing is similar to PCR, where you have all your different nucleotides, your A, C, G, T. You're also going to have these terminator nucleotides for A, C, G, and T, and you're going to have them in more limited supply than these other ones, so that every once in a while, one of these terminator nucleotides is put in, and it stops the chain at that point, and then you can run all those different size fragments on a gel and read the sequence right off. And how we do this is using these fluorescent tags. So those dideoxyterminator nucleotides are each tagged with a different color fluorescent dye. So the A's have a green tag, the G's have a red tag, the C's have a blue tag, and the T's have a yellow tag. So after you run these reactions, so in this case, this by chance, this terminator nucleotide adds on, nothing else can add after that. And in this one, this G terminator nucleotide is added, nothing can add after that, etc. So you take all of these and run them out on a gel, and this is all done by a lovely automated machine that can do all this. And you can see in this gel down here, you see all these different colors. So these are different size pieces. So you might have an A, a C, an A, a G, a T, and it draws this lovely diagram that you can read the sequence off. And I'll show you here. This is what's called a sequencing trace. So after you do the sequencing reaction, it spits out this sequencing trace, and you can read the sequence directly off of this. So this is an A for the red. In this case, the blue is a T, G, C, etc. So you can just read the sequence directly off of this trace. And this is the machine, a DNA sequencing machine, that is quickly being replaced by much more modern technologies that are coming out very, very quickly. So some important points to think about for sequencing. Yes, question. How long does it take to do that? So a few hours. A few hours. It depends how much. For a single gene, it can take a few hours. A whole genome is another story. So some important points to consider. The PCR primers are designed to amplify the specific region. So as we said, the primers are gene-specific, or they're specific to the region that you want to sequence. Now, if you don't detect a mutation, that does not mean that it doesn't exist. It just means that the region that you looked at, you didn't find it. It doesn't mean there might not be a mutation outside the region that you looked. So you have to consider that when physicians are looking at the results of a test. They have to take that into consideration. A true negative can be attained when you know the mutation. If you're looking for a very specific mutation within a family and you don't see that mutation, then you know that person does not have that familial mutation. So that's the easiest way to have a clear negative result. But otherwise, it can be kind of tricky sometimes. You know if you see the mutation, but it's not always clear if you don't see it, that it might not exist in another gene or outside of the gene in a region that's affecting the gene expression. Okay, so now I want to talk about chromosomes. I love talking about chromosomes because they are so beautiful. So last week I showed you this diagram of a human karyotype, which is basically an illustration of all the chromosomes lined up. So here's chromosome 1. And remember, we have two copies of each chromosome. So here's chromosome 1, 2, 3, all the way down to 22, and then the X and the Y. And this, you see this particular banding pattern, which comes from a specific stain. I'll show you that in just a moment. So there are many different types of chromosome abnormalities, and chromosome abnormalities are also not uncommon. They affect 1% of live births, 1%, 2% of pregnancies in women over the age of 35, and they account for about half of all the first trimester spontaneous abortions. So very often, they account for 1% of live births, but there are many abnormalities that occur that we just don't even know about because they spontaneously abort so early on. It's very common. These chromosome abnormalities can be either numerical or structural. What I mean by that is that so normally there are 46 chromosomes. So if you have 46 or 45 chromosomes, that's a numerical abnormality, or structural, meaning that a chromosome may break and rearrange with another chromosome. Okay, so they can be different structures or just a different number of chromosomes. And there are about 100 different syndromes that are known associated with different chromosome abnormalities. In addition to these types of chromosome abnormalities that are present at birth, also, chromosome abnormalities are a hallmark of cancer cells. So once a cancer cell goes along this pathway to become more cancerous, chromosomes become a mess in those cells. So this is a hallmark feature of malignant cancer cells, too. So when we look at chromosomes, to remind you, we're looking at them when they are maximally condensed during the cell cycle. So if we look at the cell cycle, looking at how the chromosome goes through the cycle, we start off with a chromosome that is a single chromatid, we call that, chromatid. It's still double-stranded DNA, but it's just one double-stranded DNA. Then it goes through DNA replication. So before the cell divides, it has to replicate all of its DNA. So once it has an exact replica of all of its DNA, each chromosome then looks like it has two strands. These are called the two sister chromatids, and they're held together here at this region called the centromere. Then in mitosis is when the DNA divides, so the chromosomes all line up, and these two sister chromatids separate. Okay, and I'm showing this to remind you that when we look at chromosomes through the microscope, this is when we're looking at them. They've already gone through DNA replication, and it's just before they divide that they've condensed down to a resolution that we can actually visualize them, that we can actually see them under a microscope. And this is a diagram. One of my students made this a few years ago. It's such a beautiful series of diagrams that she drew. This is all in an online module that she created. And this just shows you the stages of mitosis. And again, this is the metaphase when the chromosomes are all lined up before they divide. So how do we obtain those chromosomes in metaphase? Well, we take cells, either blood cells from a peripheral blood, from a blood sample, you know, when you go to the doctor and you have a blood draw, or from amniotic fluid from a pregnant woman, or a tissue biopsy or a bone marrow aspirate. Any of these can be we can obtain chromosomes from. The cells are then cultured in the lab. So for doing sequencing, we have to use PCR to make lots of copies. But for looking at chromosomes, we can just grow the cells up in a culture in the lab. And then they are treated with a particular drug that causes them to stop right at metaphase before they divide. So you have a whole bunch of cells then right at that place before they divide, and it arrests them at that place. So then those cells are harvested out and put on microscope slides and stained with a particular stain that gives that banding pattern that helps cytogeneticists, or helps geneticists, to identify the different chromosomes. And then they're analyzed under the microscope, and this is what they look like. And then these are all lined up to form this beautiful karyotype. And again, so here's the number 1 and down to the 21 and 22. And ways that we remember the different chromosomes by the banding pattern. I think I told you last week, here's a chromosome 7. It looks like a French guy with a beret and a striped shirt. And here, chromosome 6 looks like a lighthouse. See that light spot right there? And chromosome 18's over here. They look like little teddy bears. So we have lots of little ways of learning the banding patterns, learning the different chromosomes. So I'll just go over a little bit of the chromosome nomenclature. So this is a diagram of chromosomes, again, with that banding pattern that you see with this particular stain. And that central region is called the centromere, and the tips of the chromosome are called the telomere. The tips of the chromosome are like, you can think of a shoelace with the plastic ends. So it's like the caps on the chromosomes. And this arm, the top arm, is called the P arm for petite, and the bottom arm is the Q arm for Q arm. And just to show you, so this would be, these are the P arms up here, and these are the Q arms, the longer arms. And there are other ways of classifying the specific chromosomes according to size and according to where the centromeres are located, and that helps geneticists to identify one chromosome versus the other. So there are a few different molecular techniques that kind of layer on top of that karyotype, if you will, that allow us to look at smaller resolution, that can look at more. So a karyotype, it's, you can't see at a single gene level. You can look at the whole chromosome, you can look at regions of the chromosome, but you can't see a single gene. But a way that you can look at a single gene is to use this technique of fluorescent in situ hybridization. And what this technique does is uses a DNA probe, which is similar to that primer we talked about with PCR and sequencing, but a little bit bigger. And it has a fluorescent label on it. And it hybridizes, or it sticks to, binds to the region that you're interested in the genome. So you might have a probe that binds to a region of a particular gene, and it has this fluorescent tag on it. So when you look at it under the microscope, you see this bright tag if the gene is present. And if it's deleted, you don't see that. Okay. So here's an example of some real cells. So this is one of those metaphase cells, the cells with all the chromosomes in metaphase. And you can see right here, see this green and the red, and here the green and the red. So in this case, you always have one control and one test probe. So we can see that this cell has two copies of both of these genes. And down here, these are cells that are not have not been cultured into metaphase. They're just what we call interphase. And you can also use this technique to look at the numbers of chromosomes. And this can be very useful if, for example, you have a baby that has some abnormality and you're trying to find out, does this baby have Down syndrome? Do they have some other syndrome? And you want to do something very quickly. You don't want to wait 2 weeks to do a whole karyotype analysis. This technique of fluorescent in situ hybridization can allow you to count cells very rapidly and come up with a diagnosis a bit more quickly. And you can also identify smaller deletions than you would not be able to see in a full karyotype. And you can also identify if there's like a little piece of chromosome there and you're not sure what it is, this can help you identify what that material is. It's useful to know what your target is when you're doing this technique. So if you're looking for a particular gene, you use the probe for that gene. But if you're not sure what you're looking at, then this can be challenging for that. And the spectral karyotype, or the sky karyotype, is basically doing fluorescent in situ hybridization with a whole bunch of probes that cover the whole chromosome. It's basically the same thing. Another technique I want to tell you about is called comparative genome hybridization. And what this technique does, it takes, say, your patient DNA and your reference or your control DNA and compares them, hybridizes them together or binds them together, and you see if there are regions where there is more or less of the patient DNA. So is there an amplification? If there are more copies of something or less copies? Is there a deletion? So this illustrates it here. So if this is a sideways chromosome with those banding pattern, what this shows is the ratio of those two genomes, the test DNA and the control DNA, and one is labeled green and one is labeled red. So when they hybridize together, if they are equal amounts, then it comes out yellow. And the red shows that there is more of the patient sample than in the control sample, so that's an amplified region. The green shows that there's more in the control and less in the patient sample. So that's a region that's deleted in the patient sample. So this is this technique is rapidly actually being used instead of or replacing karyotype technique because it can get to a higher resolution. You can identify smaller regions of deletions or amplifications than you can in a regular karyotype. So different types of abnormalities are those that are numerical. So euploid is a term that refers to the normal number of chromosomes, 46. Aneuploid is when there is an abnormal number of chromosomes. So if you have 45, you're missing one, or 47, you have an extra one. Polyploidy is when you have a whole extra set of chromosomes. So you have 69 or 92. So these can occur by different processes, lead to these different errors. When we talk about structural abnormalities, a translocation is when chromosomes break and exchange the different pieces, okay? So it's basically an exchange between two different chromosomes. And there are lots of other arrangements, rearrangements that are seen. There are, sometimes you see a circle chromosome or you see an inversion of a certain piece. Lots of interesting things can happen with chromosomes. Now, what are the clinical consequences of these? A very important consequence is infertility. Okay, so if somebody is carrying an abnormality, they might have a lot of problems conceiving a normal child. Because remember, I said that about I just forgot the percent of early trimester spontaneous abortions are due to chromosome abnormalities. So this is a very common to see in those early spontaneous abortions or miscarriages. And they also can lead to birth defects and problems in early growth and development. So aneuploidy, as I said, is when you have an extra chromosome or a missing chromosome. And the type of disease or the syndrome that is associated with it is going to depend on the specific chromosome. And I'll show you an example here. Can anybody see what chromosome is where there's the defect here? Or where you see an abnormal number? Yeah. 21, exactly, right there. So this person has three 21s. This is called trisomy 21. Does anybody know what disease this is? Down syndrome, exactly, Down syndrome. Down syndrome or trisomy 21, and this is seen in about 1 in 700 live births. So this is one of the most common chromosome abnormalities that is seen. And it's a very common cause of mental retardation or early childhood delayed development. And here are some of the classic features of Down syndrome. And to show you the different technologies that I talked about, so here's the karyotype, fluorescent in situ hybridization, and comparative genome hybridization. So here we see three 21s right here. And if you look over here, you see red, red, red. These indicate three 21s. And over here, if you look at the ratio of two genomes, right here, this little blip is indicating an extra 21 chromosome. So this is basically all the chromosomes lined up. And down here, 21, there's an extra 21 chromosome. So these are three different ways of getting to that result. So in addition to having an extra chromosome, you can have a missing chromosome. And if you're missing an X chromosome, then, or you have only a single X chromosome, this is called 45X or Turner syndrome. So you can see down here, this individual has just one X chromosome. So they are female because they have no Y chromosome. And these are some of the features of Turner syndrome. This is a syndrome that affects about 1 in 2,000 live births. And some of the characteristics is short stature and this webbed neck you can see and some of these other characteristics. But typically these children have normal intelligence. You can also have polyploidy. Again, that is a whole extra set of chromosomes. So like here you can see three copies of every chromosome. And as you can imagine, this has very severe consequences. So if a child is born, they don't survive very long at all. It's very, very severe abnormalities. So then talking about structural rearrangements of chromosomes, a translocation is illustrated here where you have like a break on this chromosome, the blue chromosome and the green chromosome, and they swap. Now, if all the material is there, it's just rearranged, it can be just fine. Okay, the problem is that when these chromosomes segregate into the gametes, then you might have what's called an unbalanced situation, and then you might pass on a defect to an offspring to a child. So here, this is showing a balanced translocation, which means that these two chromosomes swapped, but all the material is there. So this person is themselves have a normal phenotype, but they might have infertility problems. Okay, because in their egg or their sperm, they might have what's over here of an unbalanced situation. So this one of the gametes might have this part of the translocation, but not that part. Okay, so they have an uneven amount of genetic material. And that's a major cause of infertility. And I'm showing you here an example of a balanced translocation. So this chromosome 5 and this chromosome 7 have broken and swapped pieces. This bottom of the 7 is up here. So it's all there. It's just rearranged. Okay? And this is the case where this person has two normal chromosome 7s because they got the other 7 from their other parent, but they inherited this translocation. So this could be a big problem. Okay, so for cytogenetics, then, we talked about karyotypes, fluorescent in situ hybridization, and comparative genome hybridization. So how's everybody doing? Do you want to hear a little more?
Yeah.
Okay. So now we're going to talk about whole genome analysis. This is a diagram, of, or a little picture, actually, of a what we call a microarray, a DNA microarray. And DNA microarrays allow scientists to look at thousands of genes at the same time. Okay, so you can get the size of it compared to this little penny down here. And so what a DNA microarray is taking lots of DNA from different regions and placing it on this little tiny dots on a microscope slide. It's often called a DNA chip. So each of these little dots here, these thousands of dots, each of these dots has all this DNA lined out, okay? And this technology can be used in several different ways. So it can be used to detect single gene mutations and single nucleotide changes, like we talked about last night, single nucleotide polymorphisms. It can be used very similar to the comparative genome hybridization. That can be placed on an array. I'll show you an example of that in just a moment. So it's ways of looking at deletions or amplifications of regions throughout the genome. And we can also look at expression levels of different genes. And this, so certain tissues might have certain genes on and other tissues might have different genes on. You can compare that within different tissues. And you also can compare things like within tumor DNA to normal DNA. And this is a really important use in cancer biology. So first, looking at mutation detection. So how do we do this with a microarray? Well, you lay down the sequence of a gene with the different possibilities. So in this little, in these spots here, whoops, these 1, 2, 3, 4, one of them has an A in this location, one has a T, one has a C, and one has a G. Then you take the patient's DNA and you have it labeled. So this is labeled with the green fluorescent and the patient's labeled in red or vice versa. And you hybridize it together and you see the patient's DNA, which one does it bind to? In this case, it binds to the C. So you know in the patient, they have a C in this location, okay? And it's only binding to one of them, which means that they are homozygous. So both copies of their two genes have the same sequence. Both of their genes have a C in that particular location. Down here in this region, they have an A and a C. So that means that one of their copies, the copy they got from their mom, maybe has the A, and the copy they got from their dad has the C. Okay, so you can detect whether they are homozygous or heterozygous. So again, you can look for single gene, either polymorphisms, different variations, or specific gene mutations using this technique. And also, this is the diagram that I just showed you about comparative genome hybridization. So we can do this using an array as well. So if you have the patient DNA in labeled with green, and the control DNA labeled with red, and you combine them together, and instead of putting them on chromosomes, metaphase chromosomes on a microscope slide, now we're putting it down on this array, so we're able to test many different genomes at the same time, many different cells at the same time, and you see the yellow or the green or the red, and what that indicates is if there is green, that means that there is more of the test sample, more of the patient sample. So there is an amplification of that region. Where it's red, that means that there is more of the control and less of the patient DNA. So that means there's a deletion in that region. And where it's yellow, they're about the same. So all the other regions, there is a normal amount. So this is a more high throughput way, a very fast way of detecting alterations in across the genome. And this is what the whole array actually looks like. This is of course, magnified quite a lot from the microscope slide. And here's an example of the machine, basically, that automates this, that can read all of this data and spit it out in a way that a scientist can analyze it. So you can also, I mentioned that you can look at compare the gene expression, which means which genes are turned on and which genes are turned off in different tissues. And it's very similar to what we did with the comparative genome hybridization. You're taking one sample that's labeled in with green and the other sample labeled in red. But in this case, we're not just taking all the DNA, we're taking only the ones that are expressed. So what we do is isolate RNA. So the genes that are expressed are the DNA is transcribed into RNA, and the RNA is translated into protein. And remember that of all of our DNA, only about 2% of our DNA codes genes that are expressed into proteins, right? So what this technique does is takes all the RNA from a cell and converts it back to DNA, because RNA is very unstable, so it's very difficult to work with RNA in a lab. So you convert it back to DNA. It's called cDNA or copy DNA. And this is basically, the cDNA is only the genes that are expressed in the cell. And that allows you to look at the genes that are expressed in one tissue type versus another tissue type. And a very important, this is, again, what this looks like on a whole array. And again, you can see the colors, the red versus the green. And either yellow or black is basically the same amount. That's kind of the neutral. But you can see from here that there are certain genes that are expressed in one tissue and other genes that are expressed in the other tissue. And a very important use of this gene expression profiling, it's called, is in cancer. And it's used to subtype different types of cancer, which is very useful for determining who would most benefit from different types of chemotherapy, or whether you should go in under chemotherapy or not, et cetera. So what we're looking at in this example here, you take a whole lot of that, the data from those gene arrays, and there are ways of analyzing this data and finding the ones, the patterns that are most similar and putting them together. So what we're looking at here in this row, each of these rows is a sample from a different person, a different person's tumor, okay? So all that array data is kind of spread out in a line here. So if you put this in a scientist can do different algorithms to organize this data. It's all done through a computer algorithm. And you can see here this pattern. There's more red here and more green here and more red here and green there. So all these people's tumors have separated into two subtypes. You can see here, here's one type and here's another type. And one of these subtypes might be a more aggressive cancer than the other. One might respond better to chemotherapy than the other. So if you can tell which type of tumor you have, it can help the doctor determine who should undergo aggressive chemotherapy or who should undergo a different type of treatment. And this is available for a few different types of cancer right now. There are a couple commercially available microarrays for breast cancer. There's this Oncotype DX and a MammaPrint. And both of these have a subset of genes that they look for to determine who would best benefit from a certain type of chemotherapy. And here's one of the ads for Oncotype DX. So what's the next thing? So microarrays, it's almost history already, believe it or not. We're on to the next thing already. And the next thing is whole genome and whole exome sequencing. And the reason we're moving on to this is because the technology has advanced so much that the cost has come down enough that it will be cost effective, hopefully within the next decade, to just sequence the whole genome. So you won't have to do all of these other techniques. You can just look at the genome directly and see what mutations a person has. The other techniques may still be useful for things like looking at gene expression, but for looking at mutations, et cetera, these techniques will definitely be the way to go. So when we look at whole genome sequencing, that is getting the sequence for the entire genome, right? The whole exome sequencing is looking at just the sequences that are expressed. So again, remember that it's only about 2% of the genome is expressed. So right now, this is much easier to do than the whole genome sequencing. So this is kind of a first step in getting to the place where whole genome sequencing will be cost effective. Now, this is showing the falling cost of sequencing, so you can see how this is quickly becoming attainable in our reach. It started that back in 1990, it was about $10 million to sequence a genome, and now we're getting very, very, very close to the $1,000 genome. So we have the $1,000 genome is the goal. And there are a lot of people working on this effort, the $1,000 genome. The kind of running joke in the field is that, yeah, well, we might have the $1,000 genome and the $10,000 interpretation. And the reason for that is, if you remember from the first time, we talked about all the different variations that we're seeing between humans, and it's not clear yet which of those variations are detrimental and which are just normal variants. So the more sequencing that's done and analyzed, that will become clear, and then it will be able to be more useful as a diagnostic tool. So why would you want to do whole genome sequencing? There are many times where a patient is suspected, maybe a baby is suspected of having a particular disease, or some sort of genetic disorder, but all the tests that you've done are negative and you can't quite figure out what it is. So doing whole genome sequencing is a way to identify exactly what is going on. And that can not only is that important to diagnose the child to know if it is something that is treatable or not, and it really helps that the parents give them some peace of mind as well. Screening a couple for mutations for a future child who may be at risk of a hereditary disease. Screening otherwise healthy individual for variants that have a potential significance. So there's a lot of testing that's available direct to consumer. Have everybody heard about 23andMe? That's right down in the peninsula. And there are some other companies that you can have sequencing done. So some people just want to know, what's my risk? I'll give you a little caution with the direct-to-consumer testing. It is important to bring those results to your physician because you want to know what those specific tests mean and don't mean. My little cautionary note on that. But whole genome sequencing, soon we'll be able to know what we're at risk for and what we're not at risk for. And also, it will be very useful for analyzing a tumor and be able to determine different therapeutic options and prognosis, et cetera. So with whole genome analysis, has great potential for early diagnosis for lots of different diseases. And this is kind of the charge that I'll leave all of you high school students with. There's lots of work to do, and this is a really exciting time in science and in medicine. So I encourage you to continue on in your studies and follow your passions wherever they bring you. And I hope that at least some of you come here to medical school or to graduate school and work on some of these fantastic projects that are going on. So we've talked about genetic testing, some of the different types of methods that are used to look at single gene mutations or looking at chromosomes and looking at whole genomes. And I'll leave you with that. Now it is the age of genomic medicine, and there's a lot of information out there, right? So it's information, and I hope that now with this background from these past two lectures, you'll be a little better versed in understanding what some of that information means. So I hope that we've accomplished our learning goals, that you'll be able to recognize the basic patterns of inheritance, autosomal dominant, autosomal recessive, and X-linked, and mitochondrial, and that you'll be able to describe some of those factors that affect the expression of diseases, and then also some of those methods we talked about for analyzing single gene mutations and chromosomes and whole genomes. Okay, thank you all very much. If you have more questions, please come on up.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.